Okay. Good evening, everyone. To continue this second of the series, although if you did not attend the first one, that's okay. Each one of these is independent. But the topic I want to discuss today is another topic that certainly comes up every year when you read Miguel de Esther, but has a certain prominence this year in particular, which has to do with the question of complicity when you are a bystander. And particularly, I think that this question has come up a lot over the last number of months when it comes to the question of the world as a whole, the UN, Americans worldwide, question of, complicity or amount of responsibility for what's happened in Israel. It's a question that certainly has come up a lot. And I believe that the Megillah offers a particular lens at looking at that question, which is worth exploring. I want to begin, before we begin, I want to just thank the sponsors for this year of were Anne Goldhirsch and Barry Love, Judith Hollander, Didi and Paul Applebaum, Robert and Jessica Sachs, Rachel and Yonadav Shavit, Chaim and Lisa Schramm. And thank you all for attending. As well as I want to just mention that Yishai Boyer is here, who is this week mourning the loss of his father. So we share condolences with you, Yishai. So, in order to deal with this question, perhaps the best person to look at and best character to look at is the character a character of Achashverosh. Because Achashverosh is the type of character who, on the one hand, someone who plays a very significant role in the Megillah. He's someone who certainly enables a lot of things. But one of the questions that keeps coming up over and over again whenever you look at Achashverosh is how much responsibility does he really have? How much is Achashverosh culpable for the death of the Jews or the threat to the Jews? How much is he culpable for anything happening? Or is he just a drunken space cadet who just allows mayhem to lay loose to his people, to his kingdom, and really bears no responsibility or no direct responsibility for the events that transpire around him? So that's kind of the question that I want to deal with directly. And I'm going to share here my source sheet. If you want to follow along, you are more than welcome to also. I'm going to share a link to a source, Google Drive, Google Doc. So you are welcome to just look at the whole source sheet if you want on your own, but I will share it from my screen as well.
You may need to change the access level right now is unshareable.
Nobody can open the doc. Okay. Oh, okay, good to know. Give me a second. Sorry about that. Weird. That's a default. Okay, this one should work. Or I think it's the same one, but now it should work. Okay, I see people are joining. Okay, so I'm going to also share my screen just so you can follow along. So the question that I want to really focus on in terms of dealing with this question is going to be the story, particularly of. Sorry, I'm trying to get the right screen here to share because. Is the story that's my okay. Did everyone see this document or okay? Okay, though I want to focus, sorry for the technical difficulties. The story I want to focus on particularly is this question of when Haman comes and approaches Achashverosh with this question of request to kill the Jews, what exactly is happening in the story and how much is Achashverosh responsible for what takes place? So here's the story. I'm just going to read it. You can follow along in English or in the Hebrew. Haman is incensed, enraged by what Mordechai has done. So he wants to kill not only Mordechai, but also Mordechai's people, Vayivakesh Haman, Leshmir Kol HaYehudim, Asher B'chol Malchut Achashverosh, Am Mordechai. He wants to destroy all of the Jews. And he puts a lottery, and the lottery falls out on the 13th of Adar. Verse 8. Vayomer Haman Lamelech Achashverosh, Yeshno Amechad Nefuzar Umforad Bein Hamim, B'chol Medinot Malchutecha, ודעתיהם שונות מכל עם, ודעתי המלך אינם עושים, ולמלך אין שווה להניחם. There is a people who are spread out between the various nations, between the various countries or states within your kingdom. Their laws or their customs are different from everyone else, and it is not worthwhile for the king to have them. If it pleases
Rabbi Salty, can you scroll so that we can see what you're reading?
I did scroll. Can you guys still not see?
Well, I don't.
Is this not sharing?
It's sharing, but it's not scrolling.
It's only the first seven or so lines.
Yes.
Oh, you know what? Okay,
so we can see your mouse.
I think I know what the problem is. Let me start again. I apologize. Let me share again. Thank you. I apologize for the technical difficulties. All right. Now can you see where I am? Now I'm scrolling up and down. Okay. Good. Okay. Sorry about that. So the story continues. So the king, so then Haman says, if the king is pleased with the king, he should write to the Abedotam, I'm going to leave that untranslated, and I will deposit 10,000 silver coins to the king property. The king at that moment immediately transfers his ring from his hand to Haman, effectively saying yes. The king says to Haman, you can do with the people as you would like. And as we know, at that moment, Haman sends out messengers on that very same day with the fastest of all runners. He sends it to every single people and every single country and every single official throughout the whole land, everyone in their own language, all of which is signed and written in the name of the king. And these were sent out with like the fastest runners. Verse 13, Mishloach Sfarim Be'ad Haratzim Be'al Kol Medinot HaMelech. What exactly did the letter say? Lehashmid laharog ulabed et kol haYehudim minar veAdzakein taf veNashim biYom Echad b'Shloshaasar leChodesh Neimasar hu Chodesh Adar uShalom Lavoz. That on the 13th of Adar, they are to destroy, to kill, to extinguish all of the Jews from the youngest until the old, children as well as women on one day, and plunder their possessions. Pachegen haketav linatein dat b'chol medina umdina galoy l'chol amim. A copy of this should be posted publicly in every single town. Liot atidim layom hazeh, so everyone can properly prepare for this day. Haratzim yatzu dechavim mibar melech. Meanwhile, the action kind of changes perspective here. As the messengers go out and tell everyone this message, v'adat nitzana b'shushan abira, and the message immediately spread within Shushan, the city. The response of Haman and the king are to sit back and drink. Shushan Navocha, and the city of Shushan itself is perplexed, is not sure what's happening. So this is the major question of Achashverosh. What is Achashverosh's role in this story? Certainly, Achashverosh is someone who allows this to happen, but how much responsibility, how culpable is he for this decree? I guess I'll stop now, and I'll ask if anyone has any thoughts or wants to share their own positions on this particular question. Feel free to unmute yourself.
Well, it's hard to know if Ahasuerus is just some buffoon or party animal or just doesn't care about the Jews and it's of no consequence to him. I guess those are the different perspectives I've always thought of.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of ambiguity about in terms of his
But he is ultimately responsible. I mean, the fact that he's a nebbish doesn't detract from the fact that he is ultimately responsible, even if he isn't it doesn't know what he's doing. If he had the right to do it, and he's therefore responsible.
Anyone disagree? Or I mean, yeah, or think that he's more than just like a buffoon in this setting?
I mean, he wanted the money. But aside from that, yeah, he's responsible.
He could be worse. He could be downright evil. I mean, he also, I would love to know more about backstory of his prior relationship with Haman. He's certainly allowing himself to be influenced and swayed by this guy. Did he know that he who he was who he was listening to, who he was trusting as an advisor?
I never thought of him as a buffoon. I mean, he's running the largest empire in the world, and keeping staying alive. So he must be pretty savvy, even though the story he comes out as someone who's just partying and being manipulated. But I think he wants to have, wants what Haman wants. He's using him as his instrument almost.
Yeah, anyone else have any other thing want to chime in or? Okay, so I think this is certainly, the very range of opinions. Certainly the question is, before we talk about his culpability, the first question that kind of has to be raised is the question of just like, how aware is he even of what's happening? Is he a buffoon that, is he just like drunk or who just, doesn't realize what's happening around him and he's just being manipulated by his advisors in some ways? Or is he someone who is really, if anything, savvy and maybe this is his way of avoiding responsibility? Certainly, I think anyone who's lived in the United States over the last 6, 7 years certainly knows enough parallel stories where the question becomes, and I'm not here to talk about, politics in terms of the specifics of the issue, but one of the major questions that has come up again and again and again is how much awareness does someone have when a crime is being committed in your name? Or to take a more explicit example, it's a little less political because it happened many years ago, just because Watergate was done, for the benefit of Nixon. How much was Nixon himself responsible for it? That was certainly one of the questions in the early, during the in like 74 when they first began the trial in Congress with kind of that very question. So that question certainly plays a role here as well when it comes to Ahasuerus, and how he runs the country. Because yeah, on the one hand, certainly he is this very successful king. He has 127 provinces. He is clearly very wealthy, very successful. But he also seems to be incredibly capricious. He's someone who, astoundingly, if you follow every single time Ahasuerus makes a decision, who is the one who actually makes the decision? It's never him. He always asks an advisor, or an advisor always speaks up from the very beginning of the Megillah till the very end. Every single decision, or maybe there's maybe one exception, but every single decision, it's always he asking advice. Memuchan tells him to get rid of Vashti. His servants tell him to go get a new wife to get Esther. Haman tells him to get rid of the Jews. He doesn't know what to do with with Mordechai and having given this war, so Haman tells him what to do. He doesn't know what to do with Haman, so Harvona gives him a suggestion. It's like every single time he doesn't know what to do, some advisor is telling him, in effect, what to do. So there's certainly, you know, mixed evidence in that sense. I'll just quote that even this very question is an old question. Within the Talmud itself, you can actually already see this like very classic debate. The Talmud quotes a bunch of different views, but it's a very long description. But at one point, the Talmud has the following description. I'm skipping to the kind of the very last line there. Rav Shmuel is the debate between Rav and Shmuel. Chadamar Melech Bikeachaya, Chadamar Melech Tipeshaya. One said that the king was clever, and one said the king was foolish. And I think we can all understand that this dynamic certainly makes sense. On the one hand, there's a way to read Achashverosh throughout the story as someone who's incredibly foolish and isn't aware of anything going around him. On the other hand, maybe that's specifically his savviness. Maybe that's his way of avoiding culpability, that he has a plausible deniability for anything that happens. Maybe he's just playing the fool, but really he's actually doing it really well and really suavely. Certainly that's a question that can be raised throughout Megillah. So in terms of dealing with this question, specifically in the scene we just read, the scene where Haman wants to write these letters to destroy the Jews, the question becomes, how much is the king responsible for what happened? And critically, to understand that question, is going to be, what exactly did Haman tell Achashverosh, and what did Achashverosh think was happening? Did Achashverosh fully understand what was happening, or was Haman pulling the wool over his eyes, at least partially? So take a look again at verse 8. Haman comes to the king and says to him as follows, Yeshno am echad, mefuzar umforad bein ha'amim b'chol medinot malchutecha. There is this people who are spread out between the various nations, right? He doesn't list them out. He doesn't say who they are. B'chol medinot malchutecha, v'dateihem shonot mikol am, v'datei ha'melech einam osim. They do not follow the regular laws or customs of the people. V'la'melech ein shovel hanicham. It is not worth it for the king to keep them. If it pleases the king, he should write to lose them. And I will give 10,000 coins to the king's treasure. And indeed, the king indeed does this and tells Haman to do, verse 11, and the people, whoever this people is, do as you wish. So, unclear, certainly within this narrative, does the king know which people are being attacked? And does he fully understand what's happening? And by that, I mean specifically, what is Haman suggesting to do to these people, to this nation? The same way that there is an ambiguity, what happens to Vashti at the end of the first chapter? We actually don't know. She's gotten rid of, but what does gotten rid of mean? I mean, presumably, it probably means she was killed, but there's no mention of her getting killed. Maybe she was sent to live her life in exile. We really don't know. The same type of ambiguity exists here when it comes to Achashverosh in terms of what does it mean to get rid of this people? What's the word that Haman uses to say to the king? He says to him, in verse 9, im ala melech tov, if it pleases the king, yikatev, it should be written le'abedam, to literally to lose them. La'abed, it means to lose. What does it mean le'abedam? What does that mean to lose someone? What does that possibly mean? Anyone have suggestions?
Well, it can mean kill, or it can mean kick out of the country. I'm sure there are other things.
Well, I mean, it's sort of the intentional wickedness of Haman is to use a word that he knows the king might understand one way, and he can twist to mean something else, right? Like specifically, you've chosen a word that could euphemistically just mean, like, you know, go sleep with the fishes, right? Same kind of like that doesn't actually mean sleeping or with fishes. Or it could just mean lose, like they need to be maybe assimilated, you know, or something little less brutal than killing.
It could also mean like eradicate, lose, like they won't exist anymore, like gone, lost.
Yeah, it could also mean kill. I mean, I think that's, certainly
But
one.
not just kill, just eradicate them all, like gone.
Well, hi, what you mean, like it can mean like
Like
vaguely.
to displace them or to murder them?
It could be either, but I think to mean get lost.
Right, but I think the point is this is kind of a central question. I'm not saying it's a great idea to displace people either, but there's a world of difference between displacing people and mass genocide. So it's not really clear. Within the Megillah, here's what's really interesting. So he kind of leaves it blank. He kind of says Le'Abidam. So what does the word Le'Abidam mean? Aleph Bet Daled. So within the Megillah itself, so take a look. Most of the translations, and I think the first translation that was up here was the translation. I think this is Keter, like Jerusalem. Their translation of the verse was that. Can we find it? Was to destroy them, I believe. Yeah, if it pleases the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. So there it is, as destroyed. Destroyed sounds like killing them. I mean, that's how I would interpret it. JPS or NJPS translates it as drawn for their destruction. So you have, again, destruction, killing them. Certainly, later on in the Megillah, or by later on, what I mean is 4 verses later, after the letters are sent out to the people, there it's pretty clear what Le'abed is. At that point, Haman sends out these letters to everyone, and the letters say as follows: Le'hashmid, verse, that's this source number 4, Le'hashmid, Le'harog, U'la'beid, et kol ha'Yehudim, Mina'ar ve'adzaken, Taf ve'nashim, b'yom echad. So here too, the third verb is Le'abed, but it's rather clear from context what Le'abed here means, because the first two words are to destroy, to massacre, and so, the third one makes sense also. It clearly means to exterminate, it means to kill. The decree here that Haman makes for the Jewish people is clearly not about exile. It's much, much more violent. It's some form of genocide. That's certainly way that Haman makes it clear within the letter he sends out. But the way that he tells Achashverosh, he only used that last word, the word of Le'abed. And Le'abed doesn't always mean that. Sometimes Le'abed means something different. So, for instance, if you take a look at source number 5, the way that in Devarim, during the Tokacha, during the long list of curses that will befall Israel, are they to sin? So at some point during the very, very long list, Moshe tells the people the following thing will happen. Ve'ayah kasher sas Hashem aleichem leitiv etchem ularbot etchem, kein yasis Hashem aleichem leha'avid etchem. Just as God was delighted in being able to do good things for you, so too God will delight in leha'avid etchem ulehashmid etchem, and to destroy you. V'nisachtem be'al ha'adamah asher atav Hashem lirishta, and you will be torn off from the land that you have inherited. V'efitzecha Hashem bechol ha'amim mikseh ha'aretz ve'ad kitzeh ha'aretz. God will spread you out from in the four corners of the earth. And later on, v'shivcha Hashem Yisrael ba'oniyot, baderach asher amarti lecha lo tos'if od lirota. God is going to send you back to Egypt. V'hitmakartem sham lo'oyevecha la'avadim lishvachot ve'ein koneh. You will be sent off there, and you will be sold off in the slave markets, and no one will even want to buy you. In this context, we also have the word leha'avid, but Le'avid, I wouldn't translate this as destroy. I would probably translate it as, I mean, actually, the English translation here does suggest means perish. But from context, it sounds a lot more that it's about being spread out, being exiled or lost. I mean, the same word lost, but here not in terms of killing, but almost of being spread out. You're lost because you've been assimilated amongst the various nations of the world, you've been dispersed. So, this same ambiguity exists within the way that Achashverosh himself is told from Haman. Now, how do we deal with this ambiguity Certainly the ambiguity itself, you know, is you can read it either way, but there might be some evidence pointing a little bit toward a certain direction. And I want to show you a few different things that might push us to one particular interpretation. Number one, there's this amount of money that Haman offers to pay Achashverosh for getting rid of the people. What's the purpose of the money? What's the goal? What's the purpose of the money? So one possible way, yeah.
I was wondering how much that's worth. Is that like a significant amount to the king that tempts him?
Yes, or I want to get to that in a second. I want to get
funding.
But what's the point of the money? Why is Haman giving him money?
It's just a bribe, really.
So one way of interpreting it is it's just a bribe. You know,
or pay for expenses.
Or maybe, yeah, maybe paying for the expenses. What expenses?
I don't know, of sending out all the messengers or whatever it is.
It sounds like it's more than just the amount of money for the messengers. And it sounds like people are volunteering to do the killing. Doesn't sound like they need to be paid to do that. Sounds like the money would be going to the coffers of Achashverosh, not to, you know, pay the volunteers.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing about it, right?
I think it's just to make it more palatable to the king, for whatever reason.
Oh, it's a bribe. Yeah, that's certainly one way of interpreting it.
It explicitly refers to Osei HaMelacha, though, right? So there's, you know, I agree that it sounds like the people, you know, doing that, right? Everybody's allowed to jump up and kill Jews, right? So there's a volunteer aspect there, but there's somebody who's Osei HaMelacha, right? And I wonder if that factors into what I think it was Anne was saying.
Well, Sam and Lachar are the ones who are going to schlep the money from Haman to Achashverosh coffers. I'm not clear what exactly the role is other than that. So that's certainly one interpretation. Is it, you know, it's a bribe. I think that's certainly one way of looking at it. Or there's like a whole different way of saying it, which is that in some ways maybe the money is there to compensate Achashverosh. Because Achashverosh is about to lose a bunch of citizens. And these citizens are not just people in his country who, you know, themselves may be worth something, or maybe produce to the economy, but more specifically for Achashverosh, they're tax members. They're people, they're people who gives him money as taxes.
And so, but Haman has said that they don't follow your laws. So,
well, the laws don't have to mean taxes. I mean, it sounds, yeah, certainly. Well, you could read that way. It sounds like the law is probably to do with like customs. You know, they
doesn't. But if they don't follow your laws, maybe they're being, you know, they're not contributing to the economy in that sense.
Yeah, I would assume that the language would be a little bit tougher at that point. If you have people who are intentionally not paying taxes, which is really the only form of obedience you could do back then. That's really what listening to the government means, for the most part. So you're not paying taxes, then they're not just, you know, not following our customs. They're been open rebellion. You should have said something about they're being rebellious, not just not following the customs. Certainly, you know, you can read it in these different ways. It's not clear what the money is. Laura did ask the question of how much money is this? So it's Haman tells him he's going to give him 10,000 silver, you know, talents or whatever it is. How much money is that? So, I mean, I'm not someone who knows exactly, you know, the worth of money compared to nowadays, but I don't know if anyone can, but I do know that Herodotus describes in his history, he describes the amount of money that King Darius, it's a little bit of a debate exactly who Achashverosh was he maybe Xerxes, maybe a little earlier, maybe a little bit later. He was certainly right around Darius, maybe a little bit before, maybe a little bit after, but same kingdom, same, pretty much the same exact amount of, you know, taxation collections. And there's a whole, like, few chapters describing all the various things that Darius collected from the different, you know, tributes in one given year from all these different places. And his conclusion, when he kind of adds up all the numbers, he says, this is obviously a translation, Therefore, it is seen by adding all together that Darius collected a yearly tribute of 14,560 talents. So a year worth of taxes from his entire kingdom came out to 14,000 talents. And Haman is offering the king 10,000. Now, I don't know if the 10,000 on its own suggests what the goal of the money is, but I do think that there's something surprising. Where is Haman getting the money for this? Has anyone asked that question? Where do you think Haman is? Haman so wealthy that he has 10,000, the amount of money that, you know, taxes? I mean, just to give you like a sense of scale, you know, the U.S. government, even though there are billionaires who live in the country, no one makes anywhere close to how much money the U.S. collects in 1 year from taxes. And it sounds like from Ahasuerus's people that we're talking about a kingdom which is much bigger than the United States.
He's going to take it from the Jews.
Yeah, so certainly he's going to take it from the Jews, absolutely. But it's... So, I guess the question is kind of in like, in what sense? Is he taking from the Jews because he is going to, you know, steal it from them as they get killed? He's kind of going to plunder it?
Yes.
Okay, so that's one way of interpreting it. I want to suggest is that certainly this ambiguity exists, and you can certainly read it in different ways. One way to read this terms of this economic proposition here, and this was a very common way of kind of making this type of money, and it's not maybe only about plundering, but maybe part of what he's arguing is by how am I going to get rid of these people? I'm going to send them off. And how is that going to make me money by, you know, expelling them from our country? Because I'm not just going to expel them, but I'm going to, more specifically, I'm going to sell them. Sell them as slaves. And that's going to make you money. And so if you remember from the context of Devarim, where the word avad there meant, the context there specifically refers to talking about slavery. And it's worth noting, slavery actually comes back again a little bit later in the story. Because when Esther tells Ahasuerus that there is, this person who is trying to kill us. So the way she introduces it, she says as follows. This is verse number 10. Vata'an Esther malka vatomar imatzati chen beinach ha'malach v'alamalach tov. If the king is good and the king is pleased with what I want to say. Tinaten li nafshi bish'eilati v'ami bivakashati. The king should allow me and my people to live in this request. Why? Kinim karnu ani v'ami, because I and my people have been sold. Now, if I stop verse right there, nim karnu ani v'ami, I've been sold. Most times, what would people assume sold means, or what would the end of that verse be? Sold, presumably, into, well, I'd probably say slavery. Slavery. Usually, when you get sold, you're getting sold into slavery. But she then continues and says, what were we sold into? We were sold lehashmid, laharog, ul'abed. We were sold to be killed. And then she says, ironically, V'ilu l'avodim lishvachot nimkarnu hecherashti. Ki ein hatzar shoveh benezek hamelech. If the only thing that would have happened was that we would have been sold as slaves, then I'd be silent because the pain or the trouble is not worth it to the king. The king that is not shoveh, and here the word shoveh, really means worth it, but just like in English, the word shaveh also has a monetary connotation to it. This whole story is not worth it monetarily for the king's attention. So Esther herself refers to this type of discussion about selling as slaves and kind of contrasts it almost like in an ironic way. And it's not such a far stretch to say that perhaps Haman, not only was he being ambiguous, but perhaps Ahasuerus himself had the impression that what was going to happen to these people was they're going to be sold into slavery. Now, I'm not here to justify selling into slavery. You know, it's there's a it's, you know, being sold into slavery is certainly something that's reprehensible in its own right, but there is a significant difference between slavery and genocide. And what's really interesting is that if you track the way that the word the abed is used throughout the story of God Esther, there actually subtly is a consistent change or ambiguity that plays out into what the word abed means. So we saw already when it comes to Haman, Haman himself originally says to the king, I'm going to abed on its own and for a certain amount of money. And then when he sends out the decree, he makes it very clear, I'm going to kill them. I'm going to abed amongst them. I'm also going to kill everyone from child to elder. Later on in this very same story, when Mordechai tells Esther about what's going to happen, he tells her as follows, this is source number 9, Vayagelo Mordechai ekol asher karahu ve'parashat hakesef asher amar Haman nishkol al gizei ha-melech ba-yehudim le'abedam. Mordechai tells Esther, or tells Hatach, tell Esther everything that happened, and as well the amount of money or the discussion of money that Haman said that he was going to deposit into the coffers of the king in order to le'abed otam. And Pachegin Ktavatat asher netan mishran le'ashmidam natan lo le'harot et Esther le'hagid la, as well as he showed Esther the written proclamation that they're going to kill the Jews. What's interesting here is that, in effect, Mordechai is saying three different things. He's saying, number one, Eko asher karau, whatever happened. Not entirely clear exactly what that refers to, but maybe the whole episode, maybe it refers to his own personal feud with Haman. Not entirely clear. Number two, Parshat HaKesef, the description about this exchange of money or this bribe or this, you know, offer of payment. And then number three, the decree. And if you take a look at the way that he himself refers to it, he refers to the Parashat HaKesef, the money that was given for the purpose of le'abed, le'abedam, to abed them. And then when the actual decree was written, the decree itself was written le'hashmidam, to destroy them. So, you know, is Mordechai intentionally aware of the distinction? You know, you can certainly, you know, debate that. But certainly the way that Megillah frames this, you already have this ambiguity that's being played here between the way that Haman describes to the king what's going to happen and then what Haman actually ends up sending. Perhaps the final or the best indication about Achashverosh's lack of knowledge might really stem from the end, where Achashverosh is told by Esther that there's this individual who's going to kill them. And Achashverosh responds in verse 5, Vayomer Melech Achashverosh, Vayomer Esther Malka, Mi hu ze ve'ezehu, Asher mela'o libo la'astot kein. Who in their right mind thought about doing this? Vatomer Esther Ishtar ve'oyev, a man who is an enemy of us, Haman hara ze, this evil man Haman, ve'aman niv'at mifnei melech ve'amalka, Haman is distraught, is afraid, is worried. The king is enraged. He gets out of the house. He goes out to the garden. Meanwhile, Haman is standing to defend himself in front of Esther. The king comes back and he sees that Haman has fallen onto the bed where Esther is sitting. And the king responds in anger, are you going to, you know, kill the queen while I'm in the house? And at that point, they end up killing Haman. How do we understand this story? So there are a few different ways to understand, you know, Achashverosh's response in this story. If you think Achashverosh really was, you know, in on it, so you have to either argue that Achashverosh, I guess, forgot. So he's, you know, he just forgot. He's just so irresponsible. He forgot what happened. Or you have to argue that Achashverosh is a really, really good actor, and that his, you know, his rage is fake, is made up. But both of those are rather, you know, it's a little hard to say that. If he just forgot, so why, if the concern is that he forgot, so why didn't Haman go to him and tell him, hey, you agreed to this? Like, why are you so upset? Don't, like, blame me for this. You yourself agreed to it. Instead, Haman does is he tries defending himself in front of Esther, which seems to be the wrong person, if Ahasuerus is in it on the plan. And if Ahasuerus is really, playing as an actor, his response is, almost too good. He leaves the room and he's so furious, and Haman's response is to beg Esther for his life. There's almost too much happening here that it just seems incredulous that Ahasuerus really knew what was happening. Or at the very least, it sounds like Haman realized that he's in, deep water because he did something to kind of trick the king, that he's responsible for it, more so than just having, conspired along with the king. Yeah, Chaim.
Well, there's new information in that part of the story, though, right? Because that's the first time that anyone knows Esther is Jewish, right? And so even if Ahasuerus was in on the plan, it's all of a sudden, well, wait, you didn't tell me that, with this Mifuzar Mifarad included my queen, right? And so that's, I think maybe gets some of those things to fit together a little better in that scene. Because I'm like, oh no, I stepped in it. Like, now I'm gonna have to, get Esther to make the exception that, I'll leave her alone and we won't worry about the rest of the people, type of thing.
Yeah, I think there's certainly ambiguity about that particular question, but I would respond that here too, if the concern is that Ahasuerus knew about this decree but just didn't know that Esther herself was Jewish, there should have been more of an indication about that. That was the response. The king's response is almost like, who thought of doing this? Not just, like, sounds generally, who thought of killing my own citizens? Who's going to kill your people? Who is going, his anger seems disproportionate to just having threatened Esther alone. There should have been more directly responding to it. I agree about this, you can disagree with me, but there should be, it feels like there's more, it's more, it feels like there's missing parts from the story. But I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it. Certainly, there is ambiguity there. Regardless of the ambiguity, to bring back to the, I guess, earlier question, the reason I want to push for the fact that Ahasuerus may not have known is I actually think that's a much stronger read of the story. Because if the story that Ahasuerus really did know, so then he's really this wicked king. He kind of gets away with it, and there's not much you can do about it. And, he's certainly guilty because he's, he's evil, but there's not much else you can say about it. But the message of the Megillah is so much stronger if your argument is that actually Ahasuerus did not really know fully what was happening, and yet he still is somewhat culpable. And one way of, describing that is this really, really interesting parallel that takes place between this story and the story of Kerem Navot. Now, I don't have time to really go through the full story, but there's a story that appears in the end of the first book of Kings, in Malachim Aleph, where we're told, and I'm not going to read inside, you can read it on your own, in chapter 21 there, that the king, Ahav, sees that nearby his palace, there is a very pretty vineyard, and he wants to buy the vineyard. And the individual who owns the vineyard, Navot, says, I will not sell you the vineyard. It's my parents' vineyard. It's my, my ancestral home. I'm not selling it to you. And so Ahav goes home. He's disappointed. He's upset. He tells his wife. And his wife says, don't worry about it, honey. I'll take care of it. She then goes and she conspires with various messengers to create a fake trial where they accuse Navot of having cursed the king. They buy off witnesses. The entire thing is conspired. Navot ends up being killed for having committed this capital crime, this fake capital crime. And as a result, Ahav is able to, at some point when Izebel finds out this whole thing happened, she receives it as a letter. She goes over to Ahav, her husband, and she tells Ahav, I'm reading the very end of it. Verse 15, Vayikishmo Izebel kisakul Navot, when she heard that Navot was killed, Vatomer Izebel Elachav, kum reish et kerem Navot ha-Israeli, go and inherit his vineyard because he died. And what does Ahav do? Ahav goes and takes possession of the vineyard. Now, certainly Ahav here is not a model citizen in this whole story, but he's not the worst guy in the world in the sense that he's not the one who made this whole plot. Yzevel is. Yzevel's the one who did all the, you know, crazy thing. All Achav did was he kind of let his wife take care of it and do something horrible. And yet, here's what's surprising about this whole thing. Right after this story, Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, receives a testimony from God. And God says the following thing is going to happen as punishment for what has happened. Verse 21 is verse 11. Hini mevi alecha ra'a, I'm going to bring bad upon you, meaning Achav, uvi'arti acharecha, and I'm going to destroy you. V'ichrati l'achav mashtin bekir ve'atzur ve'azu b'Yisrael, I will cut off from Achav every single male individual who is from your house. V'natati et beitecha k'veit Yeravam ben Nevat, I will destroy you like some of the other previous kings that were destroyed. As well, the gum, verse 23, Yzevel, diber Hashem le'mor, ha'klavim yochlu et Yzevel b'chel Yzevel, when Yzevel dies, she will not be buried, rather, the dogs will eat her body. Ha'meit l'achav ba'ir yochlu ha'klavim, likewise for all of Achav, the dogs will eat all of the dead, ve'ha'meit basadeh yochlu of ha'shamayim, and those who die in the fields will be eaten by the birds of prey. It's a pretty rough punishment. But in terms of the description here, what's rather surprising is who would you think is more culpable or is a worse character in this story? I would have assumed Yzevel was a much worse character. And indeed, that's the way, you know, Tanakh certainly presents it. She's much, much worse than Ahav. And we would assume then, and based on the, you know, Tanakh's usual principle of, you know, you get what you, you know, you get the rightful punishment for what you deserve for what you did, I would have assumed that Yzevel's punishment would be a lot harsher. And yet the punishment that appears here sounds like Achav actually gets a worse lot than Yzevel. Yes, it's true that Yzevel is going to die and she won't be, you know, properly buried, but Achav is not only not going to be properly buried, but all of his descendants, and it clearly is his descendants, it's not her descendants, but all of his descendants are going to be cut off. His own kingdom and line is going to be destroyed and cut off. There's so much more of Ahav's punishment here than anything that appears for Yzevel. And the point being in that story is that precisely because Ahav is not responsible in the same way, this is the novelty of this story. That though it's true, Ahav did not, you know, send out the letters, he's not the one who conspired, because he sits in the back and puts up his hand, covers his eyes, and pretends he doesn't know what's happening, that's what actually makes him in some ways more guilty. Or that's what deserves this punishment. The ability to just turn your back and pretend nothing happened. And intentionally, I actually forgot to show this, intentionally the story that we have here actually has in many ways very similar parallel. Take a look just this one verse, for instance, where similarly when Haman writes this letter to in the name of Ahasuerush, there's almost like very identical language here as the letters that Yzevel sends out to make this whole conspiracy to get, you know, kill Nevot and be able to give the vineyards to her husband. She does something very similar. The same way that Haman, we're told, Katav, B'Shem Melech Ahasuerush Nichtav, he wrote the letter in the name of the king. So too, Yzevel Vatichtov Sorin B'Shem Achav. And just like Haman signed it with the signet ring of the king, so too did Yzevel. And just as Haman sent out the letters to all of the various provinces with various different sent out the letters, so too, almost the exact same language or very similar language, Yzevel also sends the letters out. And there are more parallels to this, both linguistically and thematically. But the point being here that the end of the day, Haman's arguing that Ahasuerush is responsible is much stronger if you assume that Ahasuerush himself actually did not fully know what was happening. Because if he did know what was happening, then, you know, the Megillah's response or the characterization of Ahasuerus makes sense. He certainly is a bad individual. He's guilty. Makes a lot of sense. But if the message of the Megillah is that Ahasuerus is actually much more similar to Ahav in this case, that he himself didn't do it. And maybe he really was a little bit in the dark. But nonetheless, we judge him, just as we judge Ahav, as culpable, because though they didn't know, they almost willfully didn't know. And that intentionally turning your eyes away, pretending that I'm above the story, I can't really know what's happening, you are guilty for doing that. There's no such thing as being a bystander who, you know, pretends he doesn't know anything. Because it's not that Ahasuerus here does know something, even if he doesn't know anything. But the ability to, you know, be better than that or above this issue, to not care, to investigate, that itself is what the Megillah is saying is problematic. And I want to end with this, because this is truly one of the more powerful messages the Megillah has. And I want to demonstrate this with the following ending the Megillah has. Where is the turning point of Megillat Esther? What is the central climactic moment where everything turns around? So, another typical answer. Before I get to the typical answer, I want to suggest something that others have suggested, which is it's not Vena Pochu, beginning of chapter 6, where everything, you know, Balayla, who, Nadidash, not the Melech, sorry, where the king couldn't sleep, they had a restless night. Instead, what some have suggested is that the climactic moment of the entire book takes place actually earlier on in chapter 4. Because in chapter 4, what happens is that Esther is living comfortably in the king's palace. And she hears what happened with Mordechai. She doesn't know what happened. And so she goes out to, she sends out her messenger to find out. And right away, I want to just pose this question that not everyone always realizes, but seemingly Mordechai knows exactly what happened, but Esther doesn't. Esther sees Mordechai in sackcloth, or hears that he's in sackcloth, and she doesn't know why he's in sackcloth. Well, why doesn't she know? If this message that the king sent, or Haman sent, the name of the king, was sent already everywhere, and we're told that it was already, you know, all the people in Shushan know about it, so why does Esther know about this? Why is Esther totally in the dark? Now, you could say maybe Esther, you know, maybe it's like the woman of the palace, they really didn't have any power, and they really lived, you know, they're locked away in a cellar. It's hard to really say that. It sounds like Esther has some freedom of movement, and this knowledge is public knowledge. Everyone in the kingdom does know it, and yet Esther, it's not necessarily that Esther knows about it and forgetting it, but maybe she's almost intentionally looking away. That she knows that, oh, there's some type of thing that came about that everyone's talking about, but I'm not going to concern myself with it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to look into it. And that impression is not contradicted from the way that Esther responds when Mordechai comes to her. Mordechai then sends her all of this information, and he tells her explicitly that she should say something to the king. And Esther's response at first is after a first bit, or really second, because after first she responded and didn't know anything was happening and she wants to give him clothes. At some point, she says, I can't do anything. What can I do? I am going to be killed. I have no power here. Everyone knows, all the king's people know, nothing can happen. And here, Mordechai responds to her and says as follows. This is verse 13. Vayomer Mordechai lehashiv el Esther. Mordechai says to Esther, Al tadami v'nafsheich lihimaleit beit ha-melech mikol ha-yehudim. Do not think of yourself that you will escape from amongst all the other Jews. Ki im ha-charish ta-charishi be'et ha-zot, revach v'hatzala yamod la-yehudim makom acher. Because if you are silent in this moment, salvation to the Jews will come from somewhere else. Ve'at uveit avich tovedu, umi yodea im le'et kazot ga'at la-malchut. You and your family will be lost. And who's to know whether for this reason you came to become the queen? And I'll just point out that here too we have again the word le'abed appears again in this context, but for another time. Here in this really sharp and strong speech, Mordechai challenges Esther to stand up. And not just to stand up, but to stand up in a situation where it's not just that she's being a coward, but that she, her response indicates this sense that she doesn't need to respond because it doesn't affect her. Because it's affecting everyone else, it doesn't necessarily affect her. And that's what Mordechai is responding to. And Mordechai is telling Esther, first off, you might be wrong. I mean, he has the multiple parts of his argument. So you might be wrong about the fact that you yourself will be spared. But even if you will be spared, this is not why you became queen. Your job in Jewish history is to stand up. You will be lost to history if you don't step up in this moment. And this moment, Esther indeed steps up. She becomes a character. She becomes someone who no longer just listens to Mordechai every single moment. Instead, she actually transitions into this full-fledged, powerful character, this admirable character who tells Mordechai what to do. She tells them, you know, gather all the Jews. And very powerfully, the last verse of this whole chapter, we're told, Vayavor Mordechai, heard what happened. Vayas kechol asher tzivta alav Esther, Mordechai follows Esther's instructions. We have a reversal where instead of Mordechai telling Esther what to do, now Esther is telling Mordechai what to do. Esther has gotten up and picked up her responsibility for things that don't necessarily directly affect her, and yet she feels the need to get herself involved. And this, according to many, and this is, I could prove it, you know, almost from the structure of the Megillah, there are a lot of evidence you could prove to it, but this is perhaps the turning point of the Megillah. That the Megillah is making this point about taking responsibility, and even in situations where you very easily could just turn the other corner, turn a cheek, not care about what happened, you know, ignore what was happening to others, and Esther takes responsibility. And this idea is true not only with Esther, but arguably it's also true at the other turning point in Megillah. The other turning point in the Megillah is, this is a more classic argument, beginning of chapter 6, where the king Ahasuerus has a sleepless night, has trouble falling asleep, and what does he do? He asks for the records to be read to him. Now, when I first read that, and they read the records, you know, everything I've assumed based on Ahasuerus, he's a pretty egotistical man, I'm assuming they're going to read the part of the stories about Ahasuerus being a great warrior. They'll tell, you know, some stories of his youth and some exaggerations about the military battles he has, how much money he has. But that's not what happens. Instead, they tell him the story of Mordechai having saved him from the conspiracy of Biktan and Teresh. And at that point, the king says, "Ma na'asa yikar gdula leMordechai alzeh?" What happened? What did we do to help Mordechai or to reward Mordechai for doing this? And arguably, what Ahasuerus does in this moment is he steps up and he says, even though, yes, it's true, this is not something he has to do. He's the king. He definitely does not have to reward Mordechai for something that happened years ago. But Ahasuerus takes responsibility for his kingdom, for rewarding loyal servants in a way that he really has not until then. And both of these turning points reflect the same idea, that if the Megillah is about a story of not just evil people, people like Haman, people who want to kill us, people who have these very evil intentions, but also about the people who enable them, the people who just turn the other cheek, who don't care, people who, you know, I can't speak, for instance, exactly what happened in UNRWA. I don't know exactly in terms of how the organization works. But I am confident that even if the head organization or the people in charge specifically, you know, in Gaza on the ground don't know every single thing that are happening, part of the reason they don't know is because they're intentionally not trying to find out. Because there's this intentional wish to not care about what is happening. And Megillat Esther is telling us that yes, you can do that, but you are culpable. You are guilty. Just like Ahasuerus was guilty, just like Ahav was guilty for having killed Navot for the vineyard. If you just stand back and not just allow something to happen, but pretend that you don't know what happened and you don't put in the effort to actually find out and get yourself involved, then you too are guilty. And this message of the Megillah is something that reverberates not only in, you know, modern times, where certainly there's something that comes up a lot in terms of the question of the bystander effect and you know, the need to get involved, but it's certainly something which is true in our, you know, in the last 6 months or so, where this very question in terms of responding to the events in Israel is the question that we all deal with ourselves, you know, people worldwide. How much responsibility are everyone worldwide for what is happening in this world, for not, you know, and even for situations where you yourself might not have had the power, but if you could have found out and you decided not to put in that extra effort, then you too are culpable for not doing that work. And I hope that in the merit of Esther, who is really able to show us, you know, what a great Jewish heroine is, someone who is comfortable, someone who is, you know, safer, taking the safe route of doing nothing and doesn't necessarily have to get involved, that Esther is able to pick herself up, get involved, that hopefully in her model, we too can learn from that. And that if things were to happen, even things that don't necessarily directly affect us, we too can learn from her model to get involved and do what we can to change things for the better. So thank you for listening. That's my thoughts on culpability, Ahasuerus, and the like. I'm happy to take any questions or thoughts anyone has. Otherwise, I will see you all next week for the last in our series.
Someone asked where they could find the recording for, I guess, last week.
Oh, yes. The recording is, well, currently on my computer, but shortly will be on the Ramat Hara website. God willing. Lee Netter. Any other questions about, I guess, the substance of this year or thoughts or anything else? Not all at once.
Like, I'm thinking between last week and this week, there's still an element of looking at this story as an exaggerated tale. Like, you came back to like the 10,000 talents. Like, it's like, I don't know, if I were telling like my kid like something costs a lot of money, I'd be like, it costs $1 billion, right? And like, it's not a real number. And like, that so much of the story, you know, between last week and this week is presented in this absurdist sort of way in order to convey a set of moral a moral consequence, right? Like a fable, right? Like Aesop's fables, right? So you look the other way, you know, you're probably responsible, right? Like those, like that, these types of motifs seem to be showing up both last week and this week. I'm sort of, you know, curious to, like, if we just read the story as a children's story, frankly, as opposed to a historical text, then a lot of these sorts of caricatures you're describing start to make even more sense.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the, like, the, in terms of like the simple trend, you know, I asked the question of where is Haman getting the money for this 10,000 silver coins. So some of the responses are actually, you know, maybe it's just an exaggeration. That's not actually the number he gave. I personally don't, that particular explanation doesn't really work there for me, just because it sounds like that conversation, I don't know, you're offering the king a bribe and you're going to make up a number that's an exaggeration. That kind of doesn't really.
He was in waste management.
No, but it works not for the sake of what he told the king, but with the sake of a storyteller to a child.
Yes.
Would say, absolutely. You know, the bad guy asked the good guy. And like, you know, I'm thinking about like Austin Powers when like there's a scene like you know, you're going to have to owe me $1 million. Like, that's not a lot of money. Okay, fine. $100 billion. Then everyone freaks out. Right. It's just like, it's this exaggerated number that's just created for the sake of a story. Again, for, I mean, not to say that the author of the story lacks, you know, numeracy and knows real numbers, but it to me, it's all part of the motif of like, it's exaggerated. It's buffoonery. It's we're talking about like wicked clowns, dealing with what happens as opposed to like accountants.
I think there certainly is a relationship. I agree that there's certainly something about the extraordinary, the this what I talked last week about like the carnivalesque, something it's like fable aspect to it. The one thing that is worth keeping in mind is that if you talk about it as like a fable, as like a child story, the risk in that, and it, certainly a fair in terms of like way of reading a story, certainly a fair way to read a story, but the risk is that you almost diminish the meaning to it, that you trivialize it because it's a child story, because it's a fable, because these stories are exaggerated, or in this case, because you assume that Ahasuerus' motives are so buffoonish that he's, either he's a complete idiot who has no responsibility, or he is really an evil, conniving co-conspirator. And you kind of lose, I think, some of the subtlety and some of the, I guess, the really religious messages that come across if you just talk of it only in terms of its like fable aspects. So I think that's kind of like the risk to, emphasizing that, but I don't think that makes it not true.
I disagree, and I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm just saying that it's framed in a way that makes it so that it's like I'm contrasting it to like this week's Parsha, like Pekudei, which is like very very precise meticulous accounting of like to the level of detail of what goes on in the Parsha. And like here we have this sort of like, it's a colorful story, like, and it's not to say that Haman didn't say these things to Achashverosh, but rather that it's recorded in a way so that we who listen to it can enjoy it as a good story, as opposed to treat it as a historical narrative.
Sure. In terms of like the historicity of the story, I'm not going to
Yeah.
like debate the exact details.
No,
Not
it's like watching Hamilton on stage. Like it's a good show. I mean, like Hamilton probably didn't rap, right? But that doesn't mean Hamilton wasn't there. And it doesn't mean that he wasn't shot by Burr. It just means that it's the events become restructured for the sake of the storytelling. That's my point.
yeah, I agree certainly that the story, I mean, I think every story is, kind of packaged to tell a certain message. So in that sense, yes. Yeah, I mean, I guess another reason I'll never comment, I mentioned on the side, it is interesting that of all the books in Tanakh, Megillat Esther in some ways actually has the most archaeological evidence proving its various parts to it. Shushan HaBira, the capital city of Shushan, has been excavated. We actually know exactly where it is. It's in, I mean, it's a town called Susa in Iran. It was excavated in the 1800s by the French. Nowadays, I believe it's been mostly destroyed, I think by the, I think it was destroyed in the Iraq-Iran War in the 80s. But, and since then, I don't think, as far as I know, no Western archaeologists have been able to get access to it. But there's a lot of things in the Louvre, and there's a number of different like renderings based on just the archaeological evidence that really conform with the way that the Megillah itself describes the story in terms of the architecture, in terms of the various things that they had back then, and the way that their various customs were. So it is worth noting that the details of the Megillah itself actually do work historically way better than almost any other story in Tanakh in terms of our own evidence. All right, any other questions, thoughts? Okay, so I will see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
All right.